serving veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and just a sliver of the remarkable aviation career of Robert Thacker of San Clemente, California. He'll celebrate his 100th birthday on Wednesday, February 21st, but it's not a stretch to say he was fortunate to make it to 25. In a few minutes, we'll hear about his post-World War II test pilot adventures that included a record-breaking flight in a P-82 twin Mustang named for his bride, Betty Jo. But first, some close calls as a B-17 pilot during World War II.
We operated really out of Port Moresby, 7 Mile, over the Owen Stanley Range, and the Japanese had a base called Ley, and this mission was to destroy or beat up Ley a little. I dropped my bombs, and we did hit the airfield for a change, and my bombardier said, "I just saw four zeros take off while the bombs were going down, and in I think about 15 minutes those zeros were doing circles around me, and I had that old B-17 full bore, and the Japanese Zeros were shooting 20-millimeter cannons at us. And the B-17, the best we had was 50 calibers and 130 caliber firing out the nose. Now, an airplane made to shoot you down and firing cannons at you, which is twice as big as your 50 caliber, and flying circles around you, who do you think is going to win?"
I want to know how you got out of it, because there's no way that you should have won.
My waist gunner got a 20-millimeter cannon shell in his right on the top of his cranium, right here. Finally, those zeros left me. We got shot up pretty bad, and I thought I was going to lose my waist gunner. But we went into Horn Island, which is northern Australia, and we finally got some fuel and got back into Townsville, Australia, where my gunner could get some help, and they cut a big chunk in his head and took out part of his skull and put a silver plate in, and he was just fine. But when you see those big white balls coming straight at you, you just want to take that armor and turn it right down over your face. And you're alone now. You're only alone. One airplane, and the airplane was full of holes, of course. But that's the only. I brought back a dead tail gunner once. But you expect those things, and that's what you're paid for.
No, I hear that, and I know how many missions you had. But I just have to wonder, when you're that age and you've developed these relationships with the guys on your crew, how that hits you when you see a guy missing a chunk of his head, or you see a guy that is not going to go home to his family. How did you deal with that at the time?
Well, actually, you just pressed on, that's all. It was a little bit more personal because I kept the same crew in the Pacific, and we were flying recce and bombs. We carried half fuel in one side of the airplane and bombs in the other side. And you do develop a certain camaraderie with your crew. But in England, all of my missions were lead crews, and I took and ran the pilot off of a good crew. So I never flew with the same crew, because you're the air commander. So it wasn't too personal in the UK, but it was very personal in the Pacific, because we lost a few crews. We lost a few crews.
Speaking of personal, how often did you hear from Betty Jo while you were out there flying all over the world?
I would get a letter, maybe a couple of letters a month, because right after Pearl Harbor, Betty Jo wrote me and said, "The people are asking, where's the Navy? Where's our Navy?" And I wrote back, "The Navy is at the bottom of Pearl Harbor." Well, I didn't find that out until after the war, and I got home, and Betty Jo said, "All that was cut out of your letter, honey." Mail wasn't too frequently, but she was a beautiful letter writer, one of those people that could just write a beautiful, beautiful letter, and she was a beautiful, beautiful lady, of course. Great Air Force wife.
I get the impression that you weren't the kind of guy who was too worried about whether or not you were going to come home. It seems like maybe it never even entered your mind that you might not make it.
I can tell you right now, there was no question in my mind that they weren't going to get me.
And that's not just bravado. You really felt that then, it seems like.
Absolutely. Most people do. In fact, I don't know of anyone that in my military career, particularly during the difficulties, that thought they weren't going to make it. Most of my people were forward-looking troops as far as I was concerned. And certainly they weren't going to get me, period.
Here you had been there the day the war started for America. You had seen firsthand in very shocking fashion what had happened that day. To reach the end of the war and to realize that both of these enemies had been defeated, was that satisfying for you? What did you take from that?
I was just thankful that I could just sit down and there was no more killing going on. I just had this tremendous, tremendous relief of satisfaction that no more killings and we can live in peace at least for a few years. I didn't have a drink. I mean, I was with my sweetheart. I had just been assigned to the flight test division at Wright Field, which is a plum position, because I knew we were having all of this new equipment coming off the line that had to be tested, and I was going to be a part of the flight test division.
And I know this sounds crazy for a guy who flew so many missions in the war where there was flak coming at you and enemy fighters trying to shoot you down, circling around you like sharks in the water. But I think some people might say it takes even more guts and chutzpah to be a test pilot than it does to fly in a war. How did your wife feel about the fact that you were going to be a test pilot?
Well, I'll tell you a little side story, which you seem to think is the best part of the interview. Chuck Yeager and I were in the same test pilot school there at the academy at Wright Field. And after we got out of that, it was our first operational jet fighter, the P-80 Lockheed Shooting Star. Milo Burcham, their chief test pilot, had been killed. And Dick Bong had also been killed in the airplane. And my boss called me in and said, "Thacker, I want you to take Chuck Yeager and two other pilots, go out to Lockheed, and pick up five P-80s. It just killed our top ace, and I want you to fly $500 with no accidents." So we went up to Lockheed, went out on the dry lakes. In those days, the dry lakes was the dry lakes, and that was all there was. It was tough living conditions. So we flew the 500 hours, and I briefed my people. I said, "I want you to fly safely and always stay within glide distance if you flame out of one of the dry lakes." And the second day we were flying, who do you think I caught reporting to San Francisco Air Traffic Control? Yeager. But nevertheless, the problem with the P-80 is they had a fuel pump that was failing them, so they put a emergency fuel pump on them, and you used it for takeoff. You have to use a checklist. Dick Bong did not turn his emergency fuel pump on for takeoff. The main fuel pump failed. Unfortunately, Dick landed in a rock quarry. But when my boss called me in, he said, "You're next."
I don't think I'd feel very good about my prospects if Dick Bong, the leading P-38 ace in the Pacific and their top test pilot.
Dick was a great guy, and he was a go-getter. 40% of all the shootdowns in World War II by fighter people was performed by only 6% of the pilots. For other words, to be a... Well, Chuck Yeager got 13, so Chuck is no slouch. Not every fighter pilot is a hero, is what I'm trying to explain. Or a bomber pilot either. But to be a high-scoring ace, you are exceptional. My hat is off to him.
Well, and they sure took on a lot of risk in getting all those kills.
That's what I say. I mean, you did not have to expose yourself as a fighter pilot. The high-scoring aces went after him and did the job, and my hat is off to him.
Getting back to the P-80s, so they say, "Oh, these two guys are dead, you're next." I mean, I don't think that makes you feel very good about your chances here.
No, but you're men, and that's the business you're in, and that's what you chose to do, and go do the job. Really, in those days, you did what you were told. Today, you get a lot of back talk, I guess. People ask me, "How come that you this Betty Jo thing that you flew from Honolulu to New York, how did that happen? And I said, I was told to do it.
Let's tell everybody what this is and then finish your story. So most people, they've heard on this program about just about every plane that America flew during World War II. I don't think any of them have ever heard of a P-82. I guess what, you take two P-51s times by two and then subtract 20? Is that how you get 82?
Yeah, well, something like that. However, the P-82 Twin Mustang is the same profile as a single fuselage a P-51, but actually it was a completely different airplane, much larger in all aspects, and it was a very good airplane. The reason that nobody wanted any part of it and the job was put off to me was it was prop driven. And everybody wanted to fly the P-80, the jet. So my job was not in the fighter section. My job was accelerated service, and I've been doing most of the work with the Twin Mustang. My boss called me in and said, no, Thacker, you do this. So they wanted me to fly from Tokyo to New York, and I said, I don't think so. It might go from Hawaii to New York nonstop. Which it did, but I had to wait 3 weeks for a 20-knot tailwind. So I had to wait for a little bit of help. But we got to New York with enough fuel to my alternate, which was Boston, which was 63 gallons. So that was a good flight. It just happened to make the flight for a no-news day. So I was the news for that day. So we made every front page in the country. Hawaii to New York nonstop with a fighter, 14 and a half hours. This was in February 1947.
Yeah, it must have been a slow news day in 1927, too, when Lindbergh went across the Atlantic. Did that mean something to you, having grown up idolizing Lindbergh, that here you had a feat that in some ways was a lot like what he did?
No, you're much too kind to me. Lindbergh was really a genius. The Spirit of St. Louis had a fuel tank right in front of it for weight and balance problems. And he had a periscope that he looked out the side of the airplane to land it and take off. And he was also alone, was not carrying a lot of excess baggage. So Lindbergh was one of my idols. He's, as a politician, not so good. But as an aviation enthusiast, he was a genius.
So when you made it to New York, and as you describe, a slow news day, I don't think anyone else would put it that way, but you get all this attention, it's in the papers. How special was it for you to be able to tell the story of how that plane got its name?
I was amazed at that. You know, you just do what you're supposed to do, and that's the end of that. But they wanted to know what North American, Los Angeles area, who built the airplane. And I said, Betty Jo. I've always wanted them, because I never really had an airplane, because I was always in the lead later on in my career. And so they put Betty Jo on the side, and there we are. And she waited in New York for me for 3 weeks. And kind of a cute story. One of the managers of big hotels in New York said, where's Betty Jo staying in New York? I was waiting for a tailwind in Hawaii. And so he called Betty Jo and said, you come and blah, 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 stay at my hotel. So she went over, and they put her in the honeymoon suite on the top. And she went down the next morning and said, I'm just a lieutenant colonel's wife, and I can't afford this kind of accommodations. And the clerk said, Mrs. Thacker, you are guests of the hotel for the remaining time. So she had a marvelous 3 weeks in Hawaii, in New York City, as guest of the Hamilton Hotel. So that's kind of a cute story. I can't afford this. I'm only a lieutenant colonel's wife. And she couldn't, of course.
That's great. And that, besides being on a beautiful blanket that adorns your couch here in your home in San Clemente.
I signed some autographs for a friend a couple of years ago. And here came this beautiful hanging of the Betty Jo. And I said, honey, what are we going to do with this thing? So I just put it there on our divan, which I didn't think she'd allow it in the living room. Because you don't see the airplanes around, do you? And she liked it. So I just leave it there.
Well, it's got her name on it. How could she argue? And that plane, the twin Mustang P-82, is in the Air Force Museum in Ohio. What does that mean to you to be able to go there if you wish, or to have other people stop by there and look at something that was a part of history and your history?
Well, it's kind of fun to have people come up, and they're so nice to me. And they say, we were Dayton, Ohio the other day, and we saw the Betty Jo in the museum, and it was just great fun. And that makes you feel good. You can't help it, you know. And the Betty Jo will be there forever.
And from there, you went into the Jets, as you talked about. Can you give us a sense for what that was like for you to go from propeller-driven planes your whole life to flying these things with really unbridled power? How that felt and how you experienced that?
Well, actually, I've got two Rolls engines.
You mean in the P-82?
P-82. And in the P-80, the first operational jet fighter only had about 2,300 pounds of thrust. The P-82 that I was flying would really, with Rolls engines, would run away from a P-80 because the Whittle engine that we had in the first operational jets was very low powered. Turbine thrust and reaction is much different than a prop. When you push the throttle on a prop, it goes. With a turbine engine, it takes a little few seconds to get this thing going. So you had to watch what you were doing. And our accident rate initially with the P-80 was terrible because they were being flown by ex-hot dog aces and they were violating the aircraft. The P-80, when it first came out, accident rate was 10 times the normal accident rate. And it was nothing but violating the weapon system.
So you were one of the people that flew it right and helped show the way for all the pilots that we have today flying F-15s. And I know you're saying, well, but don't you feel like that you did something for all those pilots we have out there today flying jets, that the work you did had some value for what they're experiencing now?
Yes, I'm receiving the pleasures of your company and your attention. And so, of course, that makes me pleasant, makes me feel good. Let's face it.
Without you and those other pilots doing that, I mean, if people had said, you know what, this is too dangerous, we're not going to, you know, it's killing our best pilots, we're not going to keep up with this, then we wouldn't have what we had today. So what you guys did, the courage you showed and the persistence, don't you think has paid off in a pretty big way?
Oh, yes, of course, but that's what we're supposed to do. That's what we're paid for. And it was very exciting. I just had a ball in the Air Force. Flying has been my interest, and it still is my interest, and that just makes life so pleasant.
And we wish a pleasant and exhilarating 100th birthday to the one and only Colonel Robert Thacker. When he first shared his story on Hometown Heroes in 2013, he had just paid for his own 95th birthday party. He told the gathered guests there that day that if he made it to 100, they were paying for the party, so I trust that'll be the case on Wednesday. You can learn more about Colonel Thacker online at hometownheroesradio.com. That's all the time we have today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll join us again next time when we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free.